Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder of The New Health Club. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders and disruptors, creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. And we think that the future is already here. This episode of the New Health Club podcast is part of our Heal Soul series, sponsored by Dr. Bronner's, the activist soap company from California. Dr. Bronner's is a family-owned company founded in 1948 that makes organic and fair trade personal care products of the highest quality and dedicates profits to promote a better world for all. The Bronner family started making soap in 1858 here in Germany and carries on the family soap-making tradition today by using the company as an engine for progressive social change. I got to know Dr. Bronner's when I lived in Los Angeles, and when I went shopping at Trader Joe's, I made sure to pick up some of the delicious peppermint soap that all of us were using and loving. It was such a California thing, Dr. Bronner's, which I loved. But hey, there's more to it. Dr. Bronner's caps executive pay at 5 times the lowest paid position and dedicates all profits not needed for business development to organizations working in support of regenerative organic agriculture, animal rights, community betterment, criminal justice reform, fair pay and fair trade, and drug policy reform, which includes the responsible, equitable integration of psychedelic medicine into American and global culture. The company donated an estimate of $7 million to activists and charitable causes in 2019 alone. For more information on Dr. Bronner's in Germany, please visit drbronners.de. For more information on Dr. Bronner's globally and in the United States, please visit drbronner.com. Hi and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club Show. My guest today is Rachel Yehuda. Rachel is a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience, the vice chair for veterans affairs in the psychiatry department and the director of the traumatic stress studies division at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. She also leads the PTSD clinical research program at the James J. Peters VA Medical Center. In 2020, Rachel became director of the Center for Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Trauma Research at Mount Sinai in New York. So this is an important podcast for Germany and an important podcast for me. Even if I come at least 50% from a French background, the topic of the Holocaust is important to me because there's still the other 50% in me that are German. And I could not wait to talk to Rachel about this, since she is a specialist in researching epigenetic trauma in the context of Holocaust survivors. Rachel is a pioneer in understanding how the effects of stress and trauma can transmit biologically to the next generation. She has studied the children of Holocaust survivors and of the pregnant women who survived the 9/11 attacks. So how is it possible that children or grandchildren of traumatized parents do struggle with anxiety and depression, but not the parents themselves? This is what Rachel and I talk about. Also, how she will start to research the program at Mount Sinai to treat these trauma-related depressions with MDMA, all in collaboration with MAPS. We also address what happens if Germans undertaking a psychedelic journey start to see their Nazi past in their trip. In my psilocybin experience at Synthesis back in February this year, I spent hours in a concentration camp and talked to a rabbi, something I would never expected to see. So suddenly, in general, we would understand conflict, shame, and guilt on a much deeper level, on more levels than the political ones, if suddenly psychedelics would come into the game of understanding our history, our nation, and ourselves. But now over to Rachel and her amazing research. I hope you enjoy the show. First, of course, I would like to introduce you a little bit to our guests. So you are a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience, the vice chair for veterans affairs in the psychiatry department and the director of traumatic stress studies division at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Sounds already very impressive.
Thank you.
And so, but of course, I mean, before we get into psychedelics and your treatment, your actual research about the treatment, of course, I would like to start with the topic of how you research epigenetic trauma in families that are affected. It's like a soft word for this, by the Holocaust. And I think for most listeners and people who will watch the show, this will be already something that they hardly ever heard of. So maybe you, as the expert, start to talk a little bit about what that is.
Well, sure. My work began really in the early 90s, and we were studying Holocaust survivors because we were interested in the effects of trauma. So we were interested in studying not only Holocaust survivors, but combat veterans and rape victims and other victims of trauma. PTSD was a new diagnosis, and there was a lot to learn. In the course of studying Holocaust survivors, we made a pretty remarkable discovery, and that was that although even 50 years after the Holocaust, many survivors still had many symptoms of PTSD, and it had them for, at that point, decades, very few of them had ever sought treatment for their psychological pain or for any of their mental health symptoms. And this really struck me. We made this observation in the late 1980s and the early 90s, and it was a really powerful, really powerful observation. So I decided to set up a clinic for Holocaust survivors. I was a new professor at Mount Sinai. I'd gotten there in 1991. And we set about to try to see if we can create a place for Holocaust survivors to be treated. And we set up a clinic for Holocaust survivors, but it was the children of Holocaust survivors that called us in much greater numbers than their parents did. And at first, I was very surprised by this. My parents are not Holocaust survivors. Many people ask me that question. And I didn't understand why adult children of Holocaust survivors were claiming to be casualties of the Holocaust, which was their phrase, and trying to let me know that the Holocaust had affected them too. And at first, I kind of understood this. I mean, imagine being raised in a home with Holocaust survivor parents who were very symptomatic. That could have an effect on children. But the children of survivors were insisting that it was more than that. And we began to do research studies beginning in the early 90s, looking at things like whether there are increased prevalences of mental health conditions in adult children of Holocaust survivors, like depression or PTSD or anxiety disorders. There was. We began to look at some biologic aspects of children of Holocaust survivors. We began looking at very similar hormones and very similar biologic manifestations as we had been looking at in PTSD. And to make a long story short, there was definitely an impact of having a Holocaust survivor parent on biology of the adult child. And much later, and I guess more recently, when the field of epigenetics became popular and more understood, we began to examine epigenetic mechanisms in adult children of Holocaust survivors and in their parents. And we found, sure enough, that there were similar changes in stress-related genes in adult children of Holocaust survivors as in their Holocaust survivor parents, but not in all children of Holocaust survivors and not in all parents. So what we began to unpack was a story where, depending on whether you had a mother or father who was exposed to the Holocaust or a mother or father who had PTSD, this would provide a slightly different imprint on the Holocaust offspring. So that's the story. The story suggests that there is definitely an effect on the second generation of having had a parent who was exposed to extreme trauma, and also an effect based on which parent it was, and also what the age of the parent was when the trauma occurred.
Like, one question I think is also like immediately coming up is did you also research how the survivors actually itself are reacting? Because I remember listening to a podcast with Esther Perel, and she comes from this little town in Belgium. And she said that there were just one half of the survivors. I mean, it was a village where only survivors lived, including her parents, I think. And one part of the survivors would be actually enjoying life and being just very happy and like grateful that they survived. And the other half was just kind of making it through life. And of course, you would think that the survivors are the ones that were affected most. But then your research is basically showing that the generations after are rather the ones with the real mental health problem, kind of.
No, Holocaust survivors also had mental health problems. But the real take-home of the research is that there is, just what you said, enormous variability in the way people respond to trauma. And that's been probably the most interesting and difficult thing to understand about the effects of trauma. Why don't we all act the same? When you do animal research in a laboratory, you expose mice to some stressor. Everybody, all the mice behave in the same way. Mm-hmm. What's different, really, about this kind of a circumstance where there's extreme trauma that nobody would question how extreme it is, and yet you have very different responses, not so much in the immediate aftermath of a trauma. In the immediate aftermath of a trauma, responses are more universal. But as time goes on, you definitely see some people really holding on to a lot of pain and not being able to kind of move forward, getting really stuck in the narrative of the past and all the things that they've told themselves about what it means, while other people seem to be able to release it and kind of embrace the future and go into the future, even as someone who's been exposed to extreme trauma. And that's really been the mystery of the work in the field. And the idea that there are certain effects that can be passed on, or that offspring can embody some of the effects of a parent, provides a clue to the fact that there might be very, very complex processes that are involved in the response to trauma, some of which were in place before the trauma began. And that's a very challenging concept, but that seems to be the case, that there's a lot of variation, and that trauma exposure may release certain effects, but they may release them when the planets are aligned just so, and in some people.
And I mean, when you started the study, which was kind of like a while ago now, so you had these results, and then I think you also were looking into treatments for the people who came to you to search help. And I mean, I can already just imagine that it's a very specific setup for a therapist to treat somebody with a Holocaust background, or who was even a survivor. And the only thing I read recently was about this Dutch psychiatrist, was it Jan Bastiaans,
yes,
who treated survivors with LSD therapy because the Dutch king was allowing it for a while for him to do that. But I mean, then, as we know, LSD therapy it disappeared completely. So how did you start to treat the people that came to you with a mental health problem related to Holocaust?
Well, that's a really good question, because when we established the clinic in the early 90s, there wasn't a lot known about how to treat trauma survivors with PTSD. They weren't being treated the way they are treated now with cognitive behavioral therapies. So we really talked a lot about what we should do. I should make it clear that I established this clinic as a scientist. So I was especially unclear mm-hmm. on what kind of treatments to provide and really looked to my clinical colleagues to help me. What we ended up doing, since there wasn't an established way to treat trauma and PTSD in the early 90s, was I guess I gravitated towards interpersonal models, the work of Irving Yalom, mm-hmm. Some of the models really about interpersonal and existential psychology, Viktor Frankl. And we began to do group psychotherapy just to see what kind of things, what kind of themes would arise and how people might get better simply by talking about whatever they wanted to bring up, usually traumatic material. But until very recently, I don't think there has been a very good path to understanding exactly how to treat PTSD. Mm-hmm. Cognitive behavioral approaches that are very, very popular involve getting the patient to talk about their trauma just in a narrative mm-hmm. and teaching them kind of breathing and behavioral techniques to calm themselves down if they get very triggered or stimulated by their own trauma story. And, you know, in some sense, it could work, but many people do get way too distressed and very, very aroused. So especially when the is a very complicated trauma. And by that, I mean that it might have happened over a long period of time, that there were elements of the trauma that were not all bad, that you might have been a very young child and not understood all the implications of the trauma. So then it becomes hard to even have a narrative, let alone to keep repeating the narrative. So I think cognitive behavioral therapies work best when there is a very clear event that occurred with a beginning and an end, a clear victim, a clear perpetrator, a clear story. Mm-hmm. But for many of us, that's not what it is. For many of us, we kind of feel that something happened and we're not quite sure that how we're behaving today is really a result of that. And I can't tell you how many combat veterans I've spoken to, especially in the 90s, before PTSD became so popular, that really didn't connect the dots between the fact that they were having nightmares and weren't sleeping and weren't being able to concentrate, weren't able to express feelings of love and happiness, and the fact that they had been in a war 20 years earlier. They just really didn't make that connection. And so now we know more about PTSD. We're more quick to make a connection, but many people still aren't quite sure what the impact that events in their lives have had on them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then it becomes really hard to talk in therapy about events, not quite knowing whether how you feel today is related to those events. Many times we repress things that have happened to us, or we react to events in the current time because of something that happened in the past that maybe isn't so close to our awareness.
But then, fortunately, psychedelics came along, or you met Rick Doblin, I think, right, from MAPS. Yeah. And yes. The listeners to the audience of that show already knows we're talking about psychedelics here. But I mean, maybe you can explain a little bit again how, especially MDMA, is, let's say, the first tool that is being researched right now and also maybe approved this year for psychedelic therapy, and why it is so amazing to kind of break the PTSD situation of a person. And I mean, I'm sure you've seen that movie too, the Trip of Compassion movie. Just for those who are listening or looking at this, it's a movie from Israel where you can actually see how three people are working through their trauma with the support of MDMA, but maybe just tell us, how did you get in touch with the whole psychedelic model, you could say?
Well, actually, many years ago, when the first treatment trial in Israel was happening, a friend of mine told me about MDMA and asked me what I thought. We were invited to come and meet the investigators. And at the time, I was very suspicious about whether you can have such a dramatic improvement in such a short period of time. I really didn't understand it. And it's important for me to say that, and it's important for me to admit that, I think, because many people are still very skeptical about psychedelics and how they work. But as I came to understand it better, MDMA is almost a perfect fit for PTSD, at least theoretically, because because MDMA does a couple of things that really, really help. When people are taking MDMA, they are more compassionate towards themselves. People with PTSD have an awful lot of self-blame and guilt and shame and recriminations about the trauma that happened to them. Even when the trauma wasn't their fault, and it usually isn't, almost always it isn't, they feel that there's something that they should have done so that there would have been a better outcome, or they feel that maybe they deserved that this trauma would befall
them. Basically.
The punishment, yes. And so if you have a drug, if you're taking a medication that kind of mutes that, and you don't feel the harsh self-critical judgment about yourself that you usually feel, especially when you're talking about your trauma, that can be very helpful. But MDMA also increases interpersonal trust. So it helps you work with a therapist better. And many people with PTSD are very reluctant to disclose very personal aspects about what happened, not only because it's hard to do that, but they don't want to be judged by it. But having a drug that really increases interpersonal trust can really help. Another thing that MDMA does is it reduces fear of traumatic memories. Now, that's a gigantic benefit to somebody who is who does have a fearful response when their traumatic memory comes to their mind. People sometimes start to shake or experience rapid breathing or experience a fight or flight reaction when they talk about their trauma. That's a very big sign of PTSD. But if you have a medication that is going to mute the brain center, fear center, usually in the amygdala, then a person can kind of approach the trauma and maybe look at it differently. And that is really the whole point of trauma therapy, whether you do it with a psychedelic or not. The idea is to try to look at the trauma that occurred to you and see something different that will put it in a different perspective. And again, one of the quotes that Rick Doblin always quotes is from Stanislav Grof, his mentor, that the proper use of psychedelics can be to psychiatry what the telescope is to astronomy or the microscope is to biology. And I love that quote because it's exactly the idea of being able to look at something about what happened and see something that you couldn't see before that usually gives somebody a breakthrough. And once you see that, that really is a breakthrough. It's not a gradual process after that. It's a very rapid process of trying to integrate and really work with that insight. And that insight can make all the difference in the world. And it can be something small. For example, a child who was abused when they were 5 or 6 years old may have this very obvious realization of just how small they were relative to their abuser. But in their mind, they weren't small.
It's true.
In their mind, they were big. And why didn't they do something? And so just a little insight like that, and then all of a sudden, the rest of the story becomes a different story. And it can take you on your path to having a good life afterwards and to feeling good about yourself afterwards. So it's not so much that MDMA is a magical pill that takes away your PTSD. It provides an environment where a trauma survivor can do work that is otherwise too hard or too painful to do, or just that they haven't gotten close to doing because the environment wasn't right to do it. But once you've had that insight, then you're really on a road to recovery and resilience and even post-traumatic growth. So the magic of the psychedelic in this context is in really putting you in an altered state so that you can do something that has been hard to do in a different state. That's what I think is really good about it. And with the protocols that have been developed around MDMA, there's also a lot of preparation and integration and a lot of hours of psychotherapy, even when the patient is not taking the MDMA. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about just how much psychotherapy is involved. Almost more hours of psychotherapy are involved in MDMA-assisted psychotherapy than any kind of routine cognitive behavioral treatment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you research these sessions with people whose mental health problems are related to the Holocaust, so have you been present in these sessions, or have you witnessed?
No, we haven't given MDMA to anybody yet.
Okay,
we're just starting a center. We hope that we will be approved within the next few months to fully begin. Mm-hmm. We've already gotten our FDA approval. We're on our way. But we have not, I have not, and my team has not administered any psychedelics yet, but we're really excited about being able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And one of the reasons is that we're in very conservative, mainstream academic settings. And I think that as psychedelics begin to penetrate mainstream academic centers and more conservative clinical settings, then this could be a tremendous paradigm shift for mental health. It can really change the way that mental health is accessed and treated and viewed, and also is the gateway to making these treatments more available to those who really need them.
Well, last week was certainly a good direction to support that way. But
very, very promising. Well, we had a clear winner last week.
Yeah. The 40 winner was clear.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I wanted to talk to you about something else because I went to Synthesis, to the legal psilocybin retreat in Amsterdam in February. Mm-hmm. And it was my second psychedelic experience. The first one was with a guided LSD journey. And the second one was a guided psilocybin story. And in both kind of journeys, you could call it, I felt, I mean, they're both like 5 or 6 hours long, which you don't really feel because your sense of time is disappearing. But in both journeys, I felt like I spent 6 hours in a concentration camp. And it is, and then I was like, okay, this is maybe just my obsession with Jewish culture, or like my interest. And I was always interested in this. But then I started to talk to a friend of mine, and she was also at Synthesis with her husband, German. And she said that he's seen, like, he spent 5 hours in the Second World War, like, in his trip. And then, of course, I was like, wow, this is, of course, also something that will bring up, let's say, the story or the history of the, in that case, let's call them aggressors or the Nazis, you could say. So, and of course, this is something that might be in the future, like, insanely interesting how, like, both parties involved in a situation like the Holocaust will be able to deal with their kind of things, what they have to do with the whole situation. Wow. Do you know what I mean?
You're saying, oh my gosh, it's so fascinating what you're saying, because again, I started going to Germany for the first time in the 90s. And it is very interesting because I had was just starting to, you know, get my work out there and be invited mm-hmm. to conferences. And I kept saying no to invitations to Germany, kind of unconsciously. I didn't yeah. really think that I had a fear or anything. And then somebody that had invited me now for the third time said, does this have to do with the fact that I'm German? And I was like, he just sort of made the unconscious conscious. And I said, no, of course not. Of course mm-hmm. I went. And I realized that probably there had been something there. But what I began to realize for the first time is that Germans, second generation Germans, carry a tremendous amount of feelings and burden from what happened in the generation before them. So the story that you're telling me doesn't surprise me at all, because it was, again, so unspoken. So many Germans wanted to ask their parents, well, why didn't you hide Jews? Or did you turn someone in? Or were you in the army? Was it against your will? Did you go voluntarily? I mean, people had a lot of questions and there wasn't a lot of open dialogue about it. And a lot of the shame and the guilt of the atrocities were really a stain on kind of the consciousness of second generation, no matter what their family history was, because of the unknown. So this idea of psychedelics being able to take you out of your own limited world and connect you with experiences from your ancestors or experiences that make you feel responsible for a collective world are very healing. And I know that there is a study right now coming out of Imperial College where okay. mm-hmm. they're going to be using, or they have used, ayahuasca in the context of healing for Palestinians and Israelis.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The MAPS sponsored mm-hmm. Study. And I think it's a beautiful idea. So again, if you are in Germany and you weren't even alive during World War II, and somehow you feel that's something that can be explored and integrated in what that means, and who's to say it isn't the beginning of a real healing. And again, post-traumatic growth involves using your trauma history to then turn it around for yourself and for others. Many people that are offspring of Holocaust survivors are involved in healthcare or social justice. Oh. It's not an accident.
Okay.
It's really a thing. And so I think having these kinds of experiences are so interesting and teach us so much about what's in ourselves and what we care about and what we're worried about. And they give us just a lot of food for thought about what's inside of us. It's like really, really taking a look in that microscope.
Yeah, because also it changes the it kind of increases the perspective that has just been like a political or a society related perspective. And most people can't maybe emotionally attach or like relate to this kind of political observation. But
well, yes, that's right. I'm very touched by the story that you just told me.
Well, I mean, look, the thing is, it started with, I mean, I went to, after school, I went to have lunch with my grandparents, and my grandfather, of course, was in the war. So, and I think for years, our lunches were that we were kind of fighting, although I loved him, but we were fighting about how they did not know about Auschwitz. And this was our topic over lunch when I was 12. And he hated Marlene Dietrich. And I said, I love her because she didn't collaborate with the Nazis. This was a whole conversation for years and years until I didn't go to lunch anymore because I finished school. And I totally forgot about this. But so, and then when... the next time I thought about it was at Synthesis suddenly after this whole experience. And I mean, I think that people who have done psychedelics, in a guided and way and safe and safe set and settings mostly. I mean, this is like my topic because I'm half German, but even if they have other like, nation-related conflicts, their perspective changes dramatically. So, and of course, this like in the long run means that national conflicts can be affected by, I don't know, psychedelic therapy, for example.
I couldn't agree with what you've said more. I think, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when the conservative establishment in the United States were very worried about the impact of psychedelics and rushed to make it illegal, mm-hmm. part of that was that they could not get the younger generation to go to Vietnam. They were protesting war. And again, after you've taken psychedelics, the idea of going to war, it's such a loathsome idea.
Right? Even eat animals doesn't work for some people
That's
anymore.
Right.
It's really true.
And
some people were like, after this,
really
I couldn't
That's right.
eat a fish anymore.
Yes. So again, you know, that was viewed as a problem that needed to be solved. We can't mm-hmm. make these psychedelics available. We will not get our young generation to go willingly to war. Mm-hmm. So sitting here from that perspective, you know, maybe a better solution. I don't know. But I think that you're right. Your perspective changes. And so that might not be a bad thing. But again, we just have to wait and see. I think that mm-hmm. the steps to decriminalize at least plant medicines mm-hmm. or all psychedelics is a good start, but it's not as good as really recognizing that these are compounds that might be really, really helpful to people in many, many ways. So we have to do the research that will provide the evidence so that we can make these experiences available to the people who might benefit from them.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of the, let's say, the coming years, so what would you like to find out, or like how, what's the thesis you would like to research as soon as possible?
Well, in the coming year, I just want to see whether my team and I can safely administer psychedelics in a hospital setting. And we're very interested also in doing scientific studies that will explain how psychedelics work mm-hmm. and for whom they work and what they do. Because I think that this is a very important responsibility that we have to understand what's happening. Right now, we tend to think about a lot of mental conditions, especially PTSD, as being biologically driven. We know a lot about the changes that happen in the brain and epigenetic changes and hormonal changes. And a very important question is whether having psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy changes those things mm-hmm. and really restores people to different bodily states. Also, the experience of the psychedelic, you know, that there's a dramatic pharmacologic experience involving serotonin and lots of other neurotransmitters and hormones when you take a psychedelic, but those effects are very short-acting. And so one question is, how can such a short experience result in such a transformational mm-hmm. long-term process? And in that sense, that's exactly the question that we had when we began studying PTSD 30 years ago, mm-hmm. was the same question. How can a single event that sometimes only takes moments result in psychological consequences that last for decades or years or decades? And so we have to start looking at some of the epigenetic processes that are involved. I guess I would call it the science of integration, not the immediate effects of the psychedelic, but what happens 3 months later as you really start to come into contact with a really transformed self.
You mean also like in how the integration works, like after you kind of met the new person, your new person, your new self, basically, right? So because I remember even after the psilocybin experience, like a couple of weeks later, I mean, I think you really feel like you realize in your brain things are different. But of course, you can't really tell exactly as the person who's done it. You just, I mean, for example, what I can really confirm is that I was a journalist, I'm a writer. So, I mean, I always had so much trouble in concentrating, and I was really like everything. I was distracted by everything, and I had often a hard time to really focus on the things I wanted to write. And after doing the psilocybin treatment, this disappeared. At least it became like so really way less than it used to be. So, and it's really hard it's really difficult to say as the person who is receiving the treatment to really specifically describe what is it that happens in you. But something kind of profoundly happens.
So that's what we want to study.
Yeah,
and
I
think that, you know, I've heard that so many times. And I think, you know, people will say it's an ineffable experience. You know, I can't describe it, but people are very much aware that they have changed fundamentally. And I think that trying to understand that at a molecular level is going to really open up a lot of doors for us in terms of understanding consciousness, in terms of understanding just the drivers of how we feel in the body, how we heal, what kind of things really can improve the way we look at the world and the way we function, how our minds and our bodies are really connected. So we have the science and the tools to be able to do the work. Now we just have to focus on answering those questions in people that are taking psychedelics for the purposes of healing.
So, and the people who would come to your study, are they already mostly patients in the hospital, or is it like a whole new study that you would create around this?
Yeah, our first study is going to be with combat veterans.
Oh, wow.
Hopefully at the VA. And so we are very excited about that because this is a group that really needs healing and needs us to provide better solutions than are currently available for them. So,
well, I mean, it seems excited. That the veteran movement plays anyway like a really big part in the whole psychedelic renaissance, right? I feel like a lot of people come forward.
Well, there's no question that a lot of veterans have sought psychedelics and sought kind of journeying to Costa Rica or other places where ayahuasca and other psychedelics are available. I think that that's a small minority, though, of veterans. I think a lot of veterans are afraid of psychedelics because many may have had issues with substance abuse. And I'll tell you, in the mainstream world, people don't make such a distinction between drugs like opiates or heroin and psychedelics like LSD. To many people, all drugs are bad and don't use them. They're scary. And let's do motivational interviewing or get you to some rehab because we haven't done a good job of really listening to patients who have claimed that their use of psychedelics has been important. I remember I've spoken to many patients sometimes saying, well, you know, you drink a lot. Maybe we should discuss your alcohol abuse before we talk about trauma. And they'll say, are you kidding? The alcohol is the only good thing in my life. I'm not getting rid of that. So it's very important to listen to what people are saying and what purpose any kind of substance abuse is serving for them. Obviously, in the case of alcoholism, you want to point out things that might be harmful and be standing in the way of recovery, but you always want to listen so that you understand what people have done to try to take away their own pain and then offer them something that might work a little better since we're all on the same side of trying to alleviate that pain. So it is a very interesting thing. But just having in society the distinction between therapeutic effects of psychedelics and the harmful effects of other compounds that are even legal. Opiates are legal. Alcohol is legal.
Yeah, most of these things, right?
Many of the drugs that can be abused can be gotten legally. And so making something illegal isn't necessarily a way to stop people from taking things that they shouldn't take, but it certainly shouldn't be a way to prevent somebody from taking something that might help them. So, you know, hopefully the FDA will approve the use of psychedelics and therapists will be trained on how to use them. And we can figure out a way to have insurance pay for these therapies.
Yeah, that's the
make them available. Make them available for whatever indication we learned that they're for, and just usher in a new era where we're not so afraid of having an altered state of consciousness. But it does seem to be something that terrifies people that haven't had one.
And yeah, true.
That is something that we really want to understand so that we can help with that. What don't you want to see in that microscope? What are you so afraid you're going
exactly,
to
learn? Exactly, yeah. Well, like last time, right? I mean, like in the 60s when suddenly that wasn't... But then it's so interesting when you watch movies about the Vietnam War, I mean, especially Apocalypse Now, like the biggest PTSD movie on like ever. And I talked to Rick Doblin also about this on the show. But it's like full of substance abuse and like... self-medication. So, I mean, it really shows that everything that's related to war requires a lot of self-medication. So there's no other chance to survive a war. I mean, even other wars before had that kind of concept, right? I mean,
you're focused on getting through the day. You're focused on your survival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you don't think about that you, an hour from now, you could be, you could be in a hospital on ketamine, but you could also be dead. So,
yeah, I think so. So I think we have our work to do to kind of get the public to understand what the purpose of taking a psychedelic is, to provide reassurance about the difference between using psychedelics therapeutically and using them kind of non-judiciously, and that's in general the education that has to happen around all medicines. Most people who are prescribed a medicine for an illness, we don't want someone opening their medicine cabinet and just popping those pills in their mouth if they're given for a specific indication.
Yeah.
And so whatever our fear is, I think we have to sort of confront that fear and try to have a really sober conversation so that we can allow a lot of healing to take place. So I want to be part of that process and education because I'm somebody that came from first being very skeptical and being very sure that anything that provides a very rapid change in consciousness and mental state is something that is dangerous. And I understand how very smart people might feel that way. It's just incorrect. So it has to be, we have to replace that with a science that people can trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be the number one thing. And in my experience also that it's even like these validation systems. If you say, well, it's researched in Yale and Harvard, people will immediately change their kind of idea about things, or like they suddenly start to listen. I mean, I just saw it in the a couple of ketamine podcasts we just did, and at the moment, people hear, when they hear ketamine, they think of nightlife and mixtures from the nightlife that contain ketamine. But the moment you talk about how Yale and Harvard are researching ketamine as antidepressants, it's like suddenly people start to, what do you mean like as antidepressants? And so it seems that there are like strong validation systems seem to be a very good tool to kind of change, like your hospital or like your establishment, you could say. Almost. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That was very interesting. I mean, I have like another 20 questions, but I mean, probably have to do this in half a year when you started, hopefully, the treatment.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, that was one of the almost like most revolutionary podcasts, although it looked so super classy and like so well behaved, but it's such an interesting perspective that you have. And again, like especially for people here in Germany. And I mean, yesterday was November 9th and people didn't go out here in Berlin because of the lockdown. But the area where we are here and where I live is where all these cobblestones are, where people got deported.
Well, and it was Kristallnacht.
Yeah, Kristallnacht.
Anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah. And, or like Reichspogromnacht, how it's called now here. Reichskristallnacht. People don't say that anymore here. It seems like it. So, and because of COVID, it's kind of, you know, there was always like a little kind of a gathering of people going through the area here. And because of COVID, that didn't happen yesterday. But I feel like the perspective on the Holocaust is something that is just, could be so different in context with the psychedelic way of looking at it in the future.
I think we have a nice tool here and I hope we use it for the correct healing purposes. Yeah. And thank you very much for sharing that story.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really, really nice to hear that.
Yeah, actually. I mean, it was also so,
yeah.
I mean, twice, right? I mean, I feel like I spent my two trips in Auschwitz. Without being like a Jewish person, but I was talking to rabbis, I was talking to all kinds of people. Like,
it's so fascinating to me.
It really is because, I mean, you wouldn't go into the trip and saying like, oh, I think this time I'm gonna feel like it is in Auschwitz.
We have a shared consciousness and a shared humanity, and we're all connected. We're all connected as people, and the power of psychedelics is to connect us not only to the earth and nature, but to one another. And as we begin to put ourselves in each other's shoes, I mean, what better way to kind of build a better future? Really, it's
right. Yeah.
Profound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on the New Health Club show. It was a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.